Welcome, everybody, to the new Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdren. With me is my co-host, freezing his ass off up in Philadelphia, Barry Rose. How you doing, Barry?
I'm freezing my ass off. You're 100% right.
Pretty much. That's me, Mr. 100%. On this show, we are not going to just break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We will break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. On today's show, we're going to discuss more of my top 100. We are going to feature a special guest appearance on Breaking Kayfabe. We're going to be joined by a special guest star. And finally, Barry and I are going to discuss. Let me just say that a couple episodes back, we talked about some television shows that we wanted to recommend to the good folks out there listening to Breaking Kayfabe. And over the Christmas holidays, I had a couple weeks off. I am a government employee, after all. And I did a little binging on the old Netflix and came up with a show that I found out that Barry and I both enjoy. So today, folks, on this edition of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdren and Barry, we are going to do a deep dive on Stranger Things. Barry, how much do we both love this show?
We both love Stranger Things so much that you and I probably speak on the phone 4 or 5 times a week. We were not even doing the show, and Stranger Things is maybe one of the first things that we always speak about. That's how much we love Stranger Things.
Yeah, I don't know how I missed out on this show until over the Christmas break, and I promptly watched 2 seasons worth in about a day and a half. And besides that, I got into the Beyond Stranger Things, where they do a sort of a panel discussion with all the actors and actresses. Folks, if you are looking for a good show, this is one that you got to run to your television and check it out if you haven't seen the episodes first. But before we get to that, Barry, as always, we're going to do a deep dive on more of my top 100 of the 80s. Are you ready to go, Mr. Rose?
I am ready to go, but I have a question. What happens when we run out of 100 matches? When we've gone through all of these matches, what are we going to do?
Well, that's going to be the true test of our greatness here, coming up with something.
There you go.
Because, you know, Barry, we just always usually have a problem. We can't find things to talk about, can we? So,
well, I guess that's a good point. Yeah. All right. I get you.
And you're right. I also want to mention something before we go into our first match. I want to give a couple shout-outs here from the good folks at Facebook.com/BreakingKayfabe. You know, the other day, Barry, I put something out there. I was asking people, you know, where are our audience? Where are you from? And I couldn't believe, Barry, that we reach out as far as Australia, England, Germany, Japan. So a couple of special shout outs to my man, to Dima Bauer in Germany, Floyd McDaniel in Japan, Sam Hollingsworth in England, David DeVries in Australia. Unbelievable that I'm reaching out all points of the globe. Just is really super, super cool for me to do that. I'd also like to give a shout out to our man, Eric Chulminski, previous guest here on Breaking Kayfabe. Eric ends up raising between $7,000 and $8,000 for Takayama, the Japanese wrestler who was injured recently in a match. He was able to present the check to Minoru Suzuki. We're going to post a picture on the Breaking Kayfabe Facebook page. And according to what Eric posted, Barry, and I know you know Eric very well also, it was a very emotional moment for Suzuki to have these American fans come over to Japan, present him a check to give to his friend.
Yeah, you know, and Eric is, I got to say, he's such a great guy. He doesn't do any of this to put himself over. Is about him. He has such a passion and such a deep passion for Japanese wrestling and trying to preserve it. And I just think it's so cool what he was able to accomplish. You know, that it's a fantastic photo. I think people that see it, you realize that Eric went over with Damon McDonald and Brian Mackey, who were 2 other local guys to Philadelphia. And they've done that a couple of times. I know it's Brian's first time, but Eric's been over before. Damon's gone over numerous times. And Damon runs a podcast, or he calls it a Purocast, about Japanese wrestling. He actually, on his calf, has a tattoo of Jushin Thunder Liger. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, I actually saw that on Eric's Facebook page, where the Japanese fans outside the Tokyo Dome for the recent Wrestle Kingdom were taking pictures of the tattoo.
Yeah, so, and I've been with them, so I was at faced them at the 2300 Arena maybe a year ago, and Liger was there. And I want to say it was an ROH show, a combination ROH New Japan show, and Liger was there, and it was one of the first times they ever met. So Damon gets up in line to take a photo with him, lifts up his pant leg, Liger sees it, and they start hugging each other. It was one of those moments.
Yeah, that's great stuff. So, okay, now on to our top 100 list. We're going to discuss four more matches, three outside the top 20, one inside the top 20. The first match we're going to start off with, December 31st, 1985, New Year's Eve in Oklahoma City. Little Mid-South action as Ted DiBiase takes on Dick Murdoch. Barry, you had a chance to watch this recently. Tell me what you think.
Yeah, so I actually watched it twice, and part of it was so this is our 14th or 15th episode. You know, I'm terrible at counting, as you and I both are.
Get with the program, Rose.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I know we're somewhere under 20 at this point, but I think it's our 14th episode. And in every episode that I've been on, which is I think two or maybe three, DiBiase and Murdoch almost always seem to come up. And the truth is, if you're looking for what I consider maybe my style of what I loved professional wrestling in the 1980s, it was these guys. These two guys are the epitome of what I think professional wrestling is. And when you watch the match, it's perfect on every level. So one of the things we talk about, and I certainly bring this up, is our punches. And the punches between Murdoch and DiBiase, DiBiase's punches are just fantastic. But Murdoch's got this cool kind of killer Carl Cox punch thing going. So these two get into a few slugfests. It's just an incredible match. Murdoch, I think, had just come back from the WWF. He probably hadn't been back for too long. And, you know, there really were two different Dick Murdochs. There's this Dick Murdoch, which is a guy who is capable of being the NWA champion, I think without a doubt, if you watch this match. So there's a match from FMW, and it's Joe LeDuc versus Dick Murdoch. It's a Russian chain match. And what I think is cool about this match is it's two old vets past the prime of their career. This is probably 89 or 90, and they're just having fun out there. And they're both on the mat. I think they're both bleeding at this point. And Murdoch is saying to Joe, he's going, come on, Joe, come on, Joe. But he's laughing as he's doing it. They're having a good time. But I think that was Murdoch's rep, was here was a guy that could do comedy. He could do serious wrestling, whatever you want to call it. But he wasn't consistent. And I think when Dick Murdoch was on his game, he was arguably one of the best ever. But I really do think that there were two different Dick Murdochs. What I think is really, really cool about this match also is you're watching a match where two guys give this impression that they really fucking hate each other, and they're just beating the shit out of each other. There's no high spots in this. This isn't guys doing any sort of flips. The only high spot is Murdoch gets up to the top rope and puts his knee in the back of the skull of DiBiase and drives him to the mat. But I think the finish is great. The finish is really just a punch. I mean, and granted, it was the loaded glove from DiBiase, but it just worked. I'm going to tell a funny Bob Cook story. Bob, if you're listening, you want to crank this one up a little bit. But, you know, Bob Cook is a guy that he was a fantastic wrestler and is still a fan of professional wrestling, but he grew up as a fan. And somebody the other day in one of the Facebook groups, and it definitely wasn't the Mothership or the CWF Archives group or Breaking Kayfabe with Baldrin and Barry, it was none of those groups, but it was a group, and somebody said something to the effect of Dick Murdoch was overrated. And Bob Cook immediately, he left the group, which I just thought was so cool. Exactly. So I think this match is great. But again, I'm super biased. This is the style of wrestling in the 80s that I liked.
Well, I'll tell you what happened was when I first became a tape trader and I got my first tape with three or four UWF Mid-South TV shows on the Power Pro show. This was shown because that would have been like 5 or 6 months previously. And by that time, Murdoch had already left the UWF for Mid-South. So this was sort of like a match that was really out of their time context, other than, you know, putting DiBiase over. This was right after they had done their huge angle with Flair, DiBiase, and Murdoch that everyone who's ever had a chance to see that will tell you is one of the greatest shot angles ever as far as the way that it played out. It's very unusual, and I'm not really sure why this wasn't a bigger money-making feud. I don't know if Murdoch just opted out of the program and left the territory or what, but Murdoch is always one of those guys. You are spot on when you said that he had the ability to be a world champion. And I think Murdoch, you know, we talk about, oh, we could have had Rhodes, DiBiase, and Flair during the 80s. I think Murdoch, more so than a guy like Ronnie Garvin, for God's sakes, or Tommy Rich, would have made an interesting short-term champion, because then you could have got the more serious Dick Murdoch, because the clowning Dick Murdoch, and truthfully, during this match, there's a spot where DiBiase catches him with a punch. He goes down to the mat, and he does the curly shuffle, which is really funny and entertaining, but it seems completely out of context in this match. And as I look back upon this match, I think when I put this match in the top 100, I think in retrospect, I did that because this was one of the first really Mid-South kind of matches that I was ever privy to. I had never seen any Mid-South or Houston wrestling or any of that kind of stuff. So when I first see this on one of my first couple of tapes, I'm like going, holy crap, this is such a great match. As I look back upon it, this is a really strong match. Is it one of the 100 best matches of the entire decade? Probably not. It's a really entertaining match. I point out some stuff. One of the spots that I really enjoyed is Murdoch is tossed over the outside barricade, and he's down on the floor. DiBiase comes to get him. He kind of chases Murdoch back inside the barricade. As he does that, Murdoch reaches back, grabs the barricade with his left hand. As DiBiase is stepping over the barricade, Murdoch catches him with a hard right, and it's just a beautiful looking spot. Jim Ross is making a point. It seems apparently the thing that Bill Watts wanted to advocate that particular week and that particular time period is how much different Mid-South was from the WWF. And he pointed out that DiBiase and Murdoch are not bodybuilders because they both have tremendous stamina. They're wrestlers. So that was a key phrase. Jim Ross throwing out there that crimson is starting to flow, as I believe DiBiase got some color. They do a really good Murdoch does a really good roll in, roll out spot, which I always think is effective when both guys are outside the ring and they're doing the count. And Murdoch rolls in for 3 seconds, rolls back out to break the count. The aforementioned spot you talked about where Murdoch grabs the back of DiBiase's head, goes to the top rope, and forces his head into the mat is just a brutal looking spot, but it's so well done. So as you said, the finish is Murdoch pulls him up for a brainbuster. DiBiase reverses it. He's got the black glove Maggie, as he called it, loaded. Hits Murdoch with the punch. Down goes Murdoch for the three count. Referee Tommy Gilbert. And a really solid brawl. And pretty much indicative of the kind of stuff they were showing on television in the UWF and Mid-South at this point. Like I said, I really don't know why this feud didn't get over well. It was a really fun feud. Great matches. Maybe it was just that Murdoch is not the kind of baby face that was going to, you know, capture the attention of an entire promotion at that point. I'm not sure. Maybe he left. But this was really good stuff. I don't know if it's top 100 stuff, though.
Yeah, well, I think DiBiase was the baby face here because he had just left Skandor Akbar. It was kind of that ambiguous, you know. But
yeah, no, this is absolutely right after they'd done the turn on the Mid-South program. DiBiase went and worked the All Japan Tag Tournament and had just come back at the end of the year, and that's when they started running the return matches.
Yeah, too. And I don't know to what degree. Maybe it was DiBiase. I don't know. You know, because I want to say, okay, maybe DiBiase wasn't really going to get over as a strong babyface, but he could. I mean, he had shown previously that he was able to do that. So I just think the quality of matches, and if I'm correct, too, Murdoch was one of the guys that mentored and taught DiBiase. He was one
absolutely.
Of that small handful
absolutely.
Of guys. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, in watching this, again, I think it's kind of flawless. I would be hard-pressed to think that if you put these two into a ring, they weren't going to be able to produce something spectacular.
Yeah, and like I said, there's absolutely nothing wrong with this match. I just don't wonder if there's not 20 other matches that are it's equal, if not a little bit better, that weren't on my top 100. And we'll get into that in the coming weeks. Okay, we ready to go to our next match?
Let's do it.
Okay, our next match, the date on this match is November 21st, 1986 in Las Vegas. Nick Bockwinkel, Kurt Hennig, ESPN shown this match. I believe they might have showed it on New Year's Eve, going from 86 into 87. Barry, tell us what you think about this match.
Yes, again, you. I mentioned this earlier, but you and I speak over the phone numerous times per week, and we actually talked about this match, and we had to stop talking about it so we could save something for the show. I want to give a shout-out to my boy Chris Zaha. I don't know if you've seen his name. He is a guy that is one of our loyal listeners and loyal followers. Nick Bockwinkel was his favorite wrestler. Rest in peace, Nick Bockwinkel. But this may be the greatest AWA match post maybe 1983 or 84 that I have ever seen. This match is phenomenal. And I don't know to where to even start with this. You know, I think the commentary, let me start off with the commentary, actually. Rod Trongard says clearly in the first 2 minutes, are you ready to go 60 minutes? Which is, you know, really? Did he really just say that? like you're giving us the finish?
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. In the first minute of the match, Rod Trongard, you're saying that? Lord James Blair shoots back, well, I don't think it'll go that far. And James, again, rest in peace, you were wrong. So this is such a phenomenal match. It does go 60 minutes. You have to invest the full 60 minutes with this. I sat down and I started to watch it. I wasn't aware that it was going to go 60 minutes. 10 minutes into it, I kind of had this feeling that it was going to go 60 minutes, and I made myself comfortable. I sat on the couch, and I watched this to the very end, and it is spectacular. The only company, I think, in the entire world right now that can produce the kind of drama and suspense and buildup would be New Japan, if I was going to correlate it with anything. There's a double juice job in this, and let me tell you, sometimes blood adds to matches, other times it doesn't. It really adds to this match. But the buildup is so great. Hennig was so good here, and this is before he became this cartoon character in the WWF, where with the exaggerated bumps that I just felt were too over the top, this guy, we just talked about Murdoch, DiBiase. This guy's in the same breath of a guy that could have held the world title. And really, it's a shame that he didn't hold a world title. I realize he was AWA champion, but I'm really referring to either, you know, the WWF or the NWA, WCW. The finish is amazing. If you look at the finish, this is what a finish should be. Hennig has got Bockwinkel trapped in the Indian death lock. Both guys are covered in blood, and Bockwinkel is selling this like no one's business, and Hennig is applying the pressure, and they're literally in this for over a minute, and Bockwinkel's trying to hang on. But it does go a full 60 minutes. After the match, I think it's great. Bockwinkel is the older vet. He retains the title on a draw. He's kind of in this fetal position in the corner, and Hennig stands up and just looks like he's ready to go. And he goes over to Trongard or Larry Nelson. I think it's Nelson, actually, that has the microphone and says, do you understand? I'm just getting my breath. Do you understand me? And he says it with such conviction that I believe him. So just a fantastic match. And where did this rank on your list?
This was not in my top 20. And quite frankly, it probably should have been. Because okay, I will tell you, I absolutely agree with Barry. I watched this match, and, you know, when I first saw this, I remember on New Year's Eve, apparently I wasn't doing much in 86 because I remember being home and watching this match, and I remember it being a really good match. But with the benefit of 30 years of hindsight, as I watched this match again, you know, it was, you're absolutely right, but Rod Trongarn, who's a guy that a lot of people poke fun at, really, I thought, did an effective job of calling this match because he really called this, and we brought this point up before, he called this like it was a sporting event, you know? You had Larry Nelson at ringside during the doing the 5 minutes, 5 minutes have elapsed. And he'd do that literally every 5 to 10 minutes he would do that. So that was your tip off that this match was going a long time. Really strong mat work on this match. And, you know, as you're watching the match, they're trading. They're doing things like short arm scissors. There was one point where I believe Bockwinkel had Hennig down. He was pressing his forearm up against the ear of Kurt Hennig. Trongard actually said he's using the bone of the arm against the ear to allow for maximum pain and impact on Hennig's, which I thought was a very effective use of explaining to the viewers. And this is the kind of stuff you didn't see in 1986 or hear an announcer talk about in 1986 about how the point of pressure was being applied to allow for the maximum pain on the opponent. That's something Gordon Soley used to do in the early to mid-70s, but you didn't hear it in 1986. I have to tell you, 25 minutes into this match, before either guy had done anything remotely heelish, because, you know, and Bockwinkel does like a quick grab of the trunks or something like that. Before that, it was a straight babyface match with two guys just exchanging holds very effectively. So before I get to the finish and the rest of the match, I'm going to stop right here and do a little bit of the poking of the bear. We haven't done that recently. So I'm going to ask you, Barry, and here's a question that you aren't prepared for. Nick Bockwinkel as the world champion, was he a better world champion, quotation, than Ric Flair?
Caught with my pants down.
Well, so, pull them back up. We don't need to hear about that, mister.
Isn't that the truth? Was he a better champion than Ric Flair? If we're looking at the overall championship, he was not. Was he a better wrestler, possibly? Yes. Ric Flair, and I think the one criticism of Flair, if you're looking at maybe at this time period in the 1980s, was that he was doing the same spots in the same match every night. And whether that's valid or not, that is the number one criticism of Flair. To that end, I don't think Bockwinkel was. Bockwinkel was a fantastic wrestler. I also, and this is, I don't mean to demean anybody in the AWA in any form, but the AWA was essentially a regional promotion to me. It was a couple of states, you know, it was essentially Minnesota and Wisconsin and Illinois, but it didn't have the national exposure that, say, the NWA did. So I think Flair was a great representation of the NWA. I'm a huge Flair fan, obviously. Bockwinkel as a wrestler, unbelievable, underrated, and I think because he was happy in being in the AWA for most of his career. But I think it's a guy. I've often heard it said that Bockwinkel should have been and could have been the NWA World Champion. I think he could have been. Flair represented the NWA, and I don't know if Bockwinkel could have done that the same way. And that isn't a knock on him at all.
Well, I think one of the things that I've heard, historically, is that Bockwinkel, as you said, loved the fact AWA worked a much far more limited schedule than the NWA World Champion. That goes without saying. They were taking time off during the summer because that's just what the promotion up there had historically done. So as opposed to an NWA champion that was working probably 300 days out of the year, if not more. So I'm sure that Bockwinkel appreciated the much smaller schedule that he had to work. What I was trying to get at is, was he a better world champion? Not was the AWA better than the NWA? I mean, as a guy that was representing his promotion as their quote world champion, did he present a better world champion figure than Ric Flair?
I'm still going to say no. I think now I get, are we going because Flair was, even though Flair had the $1 million robes and had the look and everything, he was also a complete wild man. Are you going the fact that there was maybe, that Bockwinkel was maybe a little bit classier?
Well, no. Here's the point I'm trying to make. I think that Bockwinkel came off as more of a world champion figure because I've said this before on this program. I completely hated Ric Flair becoming a Four Horsemen member, because to me,
you have said that numerous times too.
And the world champion to me was always a lone wolf. I mean, you had anything where they were coming in and pay money for someone to put a bounty on the top baby face. He did that in Mid-Atlantic. He did that in Southeast. I believe he did it on Harley Race, did it on Georgia television, Dory Funk always had Brother Terry fighting his battles for him and vice versa. But the fact the world champion joined this group and always had the group to come in and save his ass, I always felt really – and I know there are people out there that, oh, my God, the Four Horsemen are, you know, the greatest group of all time, and I get that. I mean that I felt it diminished the world champion. You know, I understand that Ric Flair – it brought Ric Flair up without question. I think it brought the world champion down, whereas Nick Bockwinkel, even when he had Heenan, he was always, you know, they had the Heenan family, but it never struck me as that Nick Bockwinkel was, even though he's part of the Heenan family, he was still that lone wolf world champion when he was fighting Vern Gagne and Billy Robinson and Brunzell and all those guys. So I think at that point, I don't think it's as clear cut as you maybe think that you can say, oh, yeah, no, it's definitely Flair. Because, folks, I got to tell you something. Nick Bockwinkel, when I watch this match, he is one hell of a wrestler. And he did one, not just this match. I mean, this is a guy that he was great for the better part of 15 or 20 years. He presented himself. He came off. You know, there was a joke on the 605 Super Podcast recently where someone said, you know, whenever they post the name Nick Bockwinkel or a picture of Nick Bockwinkel, someone will instantly say, oh, class personified, Beverly Hills, California. And I get that. I'm talking about when he walked by, it was like one of these. Yeah, there he goes. There goes the champ. And Nick Bockwinkel for 15 or 20 years, even if he had the belt or if he didn't, that was a guy that was a champion. Now, I'm done with my vent. Getting back to it. So the we're 50 minutes into the match. And Curt Hennig is doing a standing drop kick. I mean, just unbelievable stamina on both guys. I thought it was interesting that when both guys started bleeding, Trongard says that the AWA officials in a world title match are instructed not to stop the match for blood. I thought that was an incredible point. Somebody threw that in his ear, and boy, that was really good stuff. And then he throws out, as they're exchanging punches back and forth, he says, one of the wrestlers has lost a tooth. Which I thought was just awesome that he pointed that out. This is a really good match. You know, we talked last week about the one match that we feel like more people need to check out. We mentioned the Chigusa dump match. Wow, this is a really, really good match and probably should have been in my top 20.
Yeah, so you really did bring up a great point. And to me, it's, you know, in looking at it, was Ric Flair brought down as world champion? We definitely, you know, this is a Captain Hijack. We definitely, this is an interesting question. Was Ric Flair brought down by being part of a group? Would it have been better had he been a standalone champion? I'm really intrigued by that.
Well,
because
I thought
the Four Horsemen, you know?
I did too. I thought he was a better world champion from like 81 to like 84, 85. Because, you know, even in 84 and 85, he was still fighting Tully. He was fighting the heel Wahoo. And then when Arn came in and they did the whole, you know, symbol of excellence. And I mean, hell, he was still feuding with JJ over the program, the short abbreviated version with Buddy Landell. So, you know, the Horseman thing really only ran for, what, about 2 or 3 years? It wasn't the long, and I'm talking about the Horseman. I'm not talking about the stuff with Steve McMichael and Paul Roma.
Thank you very much.
I'm talking about the original group. And then, of course, right, they made the change to Luger and then the subsequent change to Barry Windham. But that initial group, I thought Flair being part of that group, as good as that group was, and trust me, there were some great tag matches, six-man tags, eight-man tags, the War Games, that was tremendous stuff. I just felt it really brought the world champion and the image of, you know, that Lou Thesz and Dory Funk Jr. and Jack Briscoe and Harley Race had created kind of lessened it in my eyes.
All right. So Captain Hijack is going to pull another move right here. So this is going to be twofold, actually. And this is definitely, we're going to be raising a little bit of controversy. Your favorite Four Horsemen group, is it the original group?
I'll answer that with an asterisk. My favorite heel Four Horsemen group is the original group. My favorite Four Horsemen group as far as four great workers was the Wyndham version.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And that's, I would probably agree with that. I'm just such a huge Wyndham fan that I remember being completely surprised by his inclusion in the Horsemen. So that was a huge moment. I'm going to pull the Hijack move one more time, too, just to finish up. So since we're talking about this, your favorite Midnight Express incarnation, is it Sweet Stan or is it Loverboy Dennis?
Well, I've been asked this question.
Fans want
to
know.
Okay, fans, I'm going to tell you then. I've been asked this question before, and the way I've always answered it is, and I don't know if this is right, but it's my excuse, and I'm going with it. I thought Dennis and Bobby were the better heels. Bobby and Stan were the better team. So I'm kind of quantifying it like I did with the Horsemen.
Wow, very interesting. I'm definitely, and I love Stan, but I'm definitely a lover boy Dennis guy.
Oh, it was really great. There's no question about it, you know?
Yeah. Gotcha. All right, hijacking. Yeah.
Well, it's about damn time. So now we are going to include a very special guest and a person that has his very own podcast, which is the Kentucky Fried Wrestling podcast. Our friend Scott Bowden is going to come on because now we are going to June 6, 1983 in Memphis, Tennessee. And now I'm very happy to have joining us our good friend Scott Bowden. Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me here, Jeff.
Scott, of course, is the host of the internationally famous Kentucky Fried Wrestling podcast with some other guy. I can't remember what the other guy's name is. Scott is joining Barry and I. We're going to be discussing, as I mentioned briefly earlier, June 6, 1983, Loser Leave Town, Jerry Lawler, Bill Dundee. Before I get to Barry, Scott, why don't you tell us, since you're the resident Memphis historian, tell us some memories that you have of this all-time classic.
Well, the summer of 77, the initial Lawler-Dundee feud is what really captured my imagination as a fan, you know, with all the crazy stipulations. I believe they wrestled 8 straight weeks with the stakes and the crowds getting increasingly higher. And it all culminated with Beverly Dundee getting her head shaved. The previous week, Bill Dundee had gotten his head shaved. A lot of people said, gosh, you know, how humiliating. Well, they laughed all the way to the bank because I believe that's how they bought their house with the payoffs that they got from those matches.
A small price to pay. Small price to pay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, come on. And then, you know, they had the feud going in 79 where Lawler was really hitting his peak as a performer. He had the CWA World Heavyweight Championship. And you know, they were starting to pick up steam there, and then Lawler broke his leg. And so when the feud, and you know, and at that time the feud didn't draw that well, because fans, I felt like they had seen it before, even though Lawler was cutting these great promos. I really think, you know, they brought in Austin Idol as a babyface in 1979, and that kind of popped the house. I think they needed somebody new at that point, because they'd already seen heel Lawler against babyface Dundee so many times. But this was the reversal, and I think that was the hook and what made this feud special. And who knew that Dundee, you know, who kind of cut very straightforward promos, has a baby face, you know, he's like, Jerry Lala, I don't like ya. You know, it was just, you know, and I'm getting, there was no, his charisma was almost hidden back because he wasn't the true Bill Dundee. The Bill Dundee I know is very arrogant and outspoken and cocky. And basically he was able to go out there and be himself in a storyline that really made sense. I mean, you had all this young talent coming in. You know, the initial beef was not with Lawler. It was with Terry Taylor. And guys, and the Fabulous Ones, and Steve-O.
I always found one of the things interesting is whenever Lance would interview Dundee, he would always refer to Dundee as the scrappy little Aussie, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a way of sort of, in a way, enabling the heel to become more indignant, because it was like almost like Lance didn't really put him over as a huge star. He was scrappy, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Whether that was intended or not, I thought it was a really brilliant way of doing it. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I've always found that funny, too. My friends and I would always talk about, that scrappy little bulldog from Australia. but at any rate, it was a really slow burn. You know, Bill Dundee, you know, he came out there initially, and, you know, I wasn't savvy enough yet to quite pick up the fact that he was turning. But, you know, he was just saying that he was frustrated. You know, you have this new guy, this Johnny come lately, Terry Taylor come in and wins the Southern title. You know, where's my title shot? I've been around here for 10 years. This guy's been here for about 10 minutes. And then Dundee, you know, there was a little bit of controversy with a low blow. I think Dundee wins the Southern title. And then the next week in the rematch just turns full blown heel. And they have a great series of matches. And then it goes into a feud with Dutch Mantel. So they were keeping Lawler and Dundee apart, and I think saving them for the summer, which I think they were planning on doing probably record box office business, because this was something that was familiar to the fans. The fans were emotionally connected with both men, but Dundee still had his share of supporters, because in a way Dundee was really speaking the truth. I mean, you know, here he was, this legend, and it felt like the promotion was trying to push him to the wayside, to appeal to this younger demographic that was suddenly starting to appear in the front row at the Mid-South Coliseum and on TV on Saturday. I mean, you had teenage girls in the audience, which, you know, that was not the case like in 78 and 79.
Well, and, you know, one of the things that Lance mentions as we're leading up to the match is he says, you know, Bill's personality has changed, but he still has his fans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they made a point of mentioning Dundee's fan base. And, yeah. You know, it was kind of interesting. Barry, any thoughts from you?
Yeah, absolutely, too. So, you know, the one thing that really strikes me about this match, and it's a very, very good match. We always talk about the punches. Really, this is probably two of the better punches in professional wrestling ever. I want to say that Lawler had the best punch, and then I look at Dundee and go, my God, he's fantastic. But you were there, Scott. Did anybody truly think that Lawler was actually going to lose?
You know what? It's hard to say, because perhaps because Lawler's star had risen. You know, this was about a year after the Andy Kaufman deal. You know, he's appearing on David Letterman. I see him in the magazines. He's teaming with David Von Erich in St. Louis. So to me, there was a possibility that he could lose. And they did such a great job. You know, they got Freddie Miller from Georgia Championship Wrestling to cut a promo saying that they would love to have either one. I was watching the Saturday afternoon TBS show, and Ole Anderson and Freddie Miller are talking about this match coming up in Memphis on Monday. It was incredible. So that helped sell it, that, you know, the idea that the result, you know, was in doubt.
By the way, at this point, can I just interject and say Freddie Miller, possibly the worst rug in the history of the wrestling business. Barry, your thoughts?
Tony Marino in 1977 was pretty bad, but yeah, Freddie Miller. But that was a great answer. And so for me, being an outsider, not somebody that was in Memphis, I look at it and go, come on, Lawler's the king of Memphis. He's never going to leave. But you bring up these great points about the whole Andy Kaufman thing and then the St. Louis thing. I will say this too, as I watch this match, and granted, Lawler and Dundee had probably wrestled each other 45,000 times at this point. To have 11,000 people emotionally invested into a match that they've seen hundreds of times before, has there ever been a promotion in the history of wrestling that understood the fan base and what the fans wanted more than Memphis? Honestly, I don't think that there has. And I would always go back and I would say, you know, Texas and the Von Erichs, because they understood it. But I think the strong point for Memphis is really the knowledge of knowing what those fans wanted to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't think there's any. So as I look back on this match, and what I did was, there is available out there a segment that shows sort of the buildup to the match. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, Scott, was how quick, based on the fact that Dundee had taken the job as the booker for the new promotion in Georgia, how quick was this program accelerated? If you could give us just an idea.
Oh man, I think it was really, it was really on the fast track. Dundee and Lawler had really not had a confrontation yet. And suddenly he interferes in a match between the King and Ken Patera and costs Lawler $5,000. And that leads to their first match, which was held the week before the Loser Leave Town match. And it was classic. I mean, it was a classic match.
Well, and then what they did was they had a program that was basically, the entire program was Dundee and Lawler sitting at the table discussing the match. And it was interesting. There was some interviews that Lance did where he's talking to Jerry Lawler and he's going, now, King, we've heard these rumors and speculation. And he's like, well, we were never really friends, but now we're kind of not really getting along. And I don't know, the chemistry just isn't the same, just real kind of subtle stuff. Then they go over to Dundee and they're interviewing him. He brings up the Kaufman situation and says, you know, what has Lawler done since Kaufman left? He's really hasn't done anything. Very subtly kind of giving a dig to the king. And then as he's talking about it, a great line that Dundee threw out there was, you know, people really don't know Jerry Lawler. This is like a Watergate cover-up, you know, the truth about Jerry Lawler. And one of the things that as I was observing that and listening to Dundee's interview, I believe, Barry, you can help me on this. Was it Gary Hart that said the best heels are the ones that completely believe what they're saying in their interviews and promotions? They have to invest that what they're saying is right to really be, get over as a heel. Was it Gary Hart that said that?
Yeah, I think that was actually quoted from his book as well. Yeah, you're correct.
Yeah, and so then they have Dundee on there, and one of the things that just absolutely cracked me up was they go, we're going to see this workout video with Bill Dundee. So I'm obviously, you know what I'm talking about.
With the violins playing. Yeah.
No. I tell you what the song is, whether you know it or not, the song that they play as they show Bill Dundee doing a bench press. Okay. And Dundee's talking about, oh, Jerry Lawler, you've never lifted that much weight in your whole life. But the song they're playing is The Windmills of Your Mind. which is from the movie The Thomas Crown Affair, which, by the way, was like 15 years before that. So just where did they pull that song reference from? So, and then.
See, this is why I say this show is the art house indie of the Arcadian Vanguard. Yes, the highbrow.
They're very highbrow, yes.
Yes.
So Bill compares he and Lawler to cars and says, you know, Jerry Lawler is like a Cadillac, which is used to be popular a few years ago, but I'm a Lincoln, baby. I'm not what's now and what's happening. And then the fact that they have the area stars, Valiant and a few other guys, Ricky and Robert, discussing who they think is going to win the match with very effective promotional tactic. And then the fact that they have all the guys in the promotion sitting in the front row watching the match.
Yeah, that made it very special. I had never seen that done before. And that made it sound like to me, or seem like to me, that, man, even I have to be there. You know, even as a wrestler, you know, there's a fan inside me that has to be there to see this match. And one thing to consider, too, you know, when you're talking about the buildup for this match or these matches, because, you know, they had, by the time the live Memphis show aired on, I believe it was June 4th, you know, they had already wrestled the Loser Leave Town match in Lexington, and they were actually going to wrestle the Loser Leave Town match that very same night in Nashville. So by the time they got to Memphis, they had already had virtually the same match. So I like to say they had it down to a science. By the time they got to Memphis, so that had to be the best one of the series. And then the next night they had to travel all the way to Louisville. There's no way that one. Now, Travis Heckle, I think our resident artist here at the, Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, I think he disagrees, saying that it was a classic match, but how could it have been? How could it have been better than the Memphis match? So what you're talking about, you know, this match, it wasn't really one match. It was a series of bouts, and they drew, I think, $120,000 combined, which is amazing for towns that a promotion was running every single week.
Yeah. And, you know, I believe, and you had sent me an article that you had written about this program. They ran the same Loser Leave Town match from, I believe, the 2nd of June through the 7th of June. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think Lexington was June 2nd, Nashville was June 4th, Memphis was June 6th, and then Louisville the next night, the 7th, which meant that there are two build-up shows. There's one that was at Jerry Jarrett's house, and there's one that was live in the studio. And they're virtually the same show. The exchanges are the same. The clips are the same. The only difference is you have some live matches. Lawler and Dundee both actually wrestle, and there's almost a physical confrontation. But other than that, you know, and that was unique because typically Memphis would get the big match first and then the rest of the territory would get, you know, the bicycle tape.
Sure.
And so this was sort of unique that the bout had already taken place in Lexington and Nashville by the time, they did it in Memphis.
Yeah. So just to finish up, on the match itself, Bill Dundee, one of the things I liked was, and I got to be honest with you, I don't know if there was a single actual wrestling hold in this match. It's a straight up brawl. Bill Dundee is doing these spots where Lawler is standing on the apron outside the ring ropes, and Dundee would slide and cut his legs out from under him, which is a great spot. They get outside the ring on the floor, and this old lady comes running up to the ring bearers holding up this sign that says "Bye Bye Bill," which I thought was really funny. Dundee uses some punches to open up Lawler's eye. Lawler does the spot where he's on the apron, gets the shoulder tackle, jumps onto the ringside table, which that was it almost seems like that was a patented spot.
I love that too, because I believe that's supposedly what busted him open. Like Dundee's working on him, I think, and then when he hits the table, I believe that's the thing that just really pops the eye open.
Okay.
But one thing I love about that, I don't know if you'll notice, but Jerry Jarrett is sitting at ringside, and when Lawler hits that table, even Jerry Jarrett recoils in horror. You know, Jerry Jarrett's a man who's been around forever. He's seen everything, and it that little thing told me, like, this is the most brutal match that he's ever seen between these two, which covers a lot of ground, because these two really did not care for one another. And so it was very easy for them to go out there and project and to be in the moment in their promos, because there was a lot about each other that they just absolutely hated. And when they worked, it was always, you know, those matches in 77, man, the punches were so stiff and so realistic. They were snug. Let's just say that.
Yeah. So
the pile driver too. That pile driver.
Oh, yeah.
Has there ever been a better pile driver in professional wrestling?
I don't think so. I the only one I can think of, maybe Paul Orndorff, I think had a great pile driver. I hated, like, Bob Backlund had the worst pile driver, and Harley Race. Ric Flair couldn't do a pile driver to save his life. Now the King, I love the way he got the elevation, but he always protected you. I mean, I'm proud to say that I took two or three pile drivers and lived to tell about it. So,
so the finish of the match has Dundee cutting Lawler's legs out from him with shoulder tackles, and he does about, I don't know, two, maybe three. And as he comes in for another one, Lawler catches him on the uppercut, then hits the pile driver. Match goes about 22 minutes, a really, really good match. The setup for the match, again, we've mentioned this on a few occasions on this show, really added to it. And, you know, as Scott has said, imagine if they had really been given the full benefit of the time to allow for the slow burn. This was done sort of at an accelerated rate. Still great. But if they'd really been allowed to, you know, take this thing into July or even into August, it would have been even greater. So now, all that being said, let me ask you, since you said that you first saw this feud in 77, you had 77, 79, 83, and then you had the 85 into 86, where Dundee and, you know, Lawler had Landell and Mantell also in that equation. Which one of those do you remember the best and most fondly?
Well, the summer of 77, obviously, is near and dear to my heart, because that's what really captured me as a fan, you know, and I think it's remarkable too that they were able to come back with the same two guys on top and draw that kind of money. You know, I think the crowds gradually went from 7,000 to 9,000 to 10,000. I think they had one sellout, and then, you know, it was incredible for the two guys that work in the same town every single week draw that kind of money. But I will have to say that the Landell, Dundee, Lawler, Mantell thing, that was very special too, because that was the last sellout at the Mid-South Coliseum, you know, and people thought, man, Memphis's days of selling out are over. There'll never be another one. And, you know, even with the Rich Idol feud, that didn't sell out. The I was there for the hair match. They drew about 9,000 people. But that, for a moment, that angle was so personal and so well executed, where they beat up Jeff Jarrett, and that brought out Jerry Jarrett. They went for his eye. That sort of reinvigorated Memphis, and for about 4 or 5 months, the Memphis Magic was back. It felt like Saturday mornings back in its heyday all over again.
How great was Jerry Jarrett coming out there crying and telling Lance that he's not a man because he couldn't defend his son?
That was so awesome. Unbelievable. As Lawler would say, that would bring a tear to a glass eye. And I guess it sort of did.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, well, listen, Scott, we really want to thank you for adding your historical context to this particular match and this program.
And I would like to say one last thing about this, you know, because I posted this match, on its anniversary on Twitter, and so many new fans, I guess, who had never seen it before, they were just blown away by the punches and how stiff this match looked. And a lot of people commented, like, I can't believe a video like this was put together in 1983. Because it's so well done with the whole Rocky music and I think it's the best wrestling video ever made.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, and Barry, you can chime in on this, Dundee and Lawler or Steamboat and Flair, which pair had the most matches against one another?
I'm going to say Dundee Lawler, I would believe, had the most matches. I don't know, though. That's an interesting question.
I'd say that's probably fairly accurate, you know, because when Flair won the title, he was on the road a lot. They were separated for years when Steamboat would be in WWF. And again, Lawler and Dundee work in the same towns weekly. I don't know. I mean, I think I would give the nod to Lawler and Dundee.
Well, and the only reason I say that is because, you know, Flair has been quoted as saying that he and Steamboat in the like, I guess, 1977 through like 1980. He said him and Steamboat were working 300 nights a year with one another. And
sleeping with like 600 women a year.
Just Flair. We don't want to, Steamboat.
Oh, no. I don't know.
So, but anyway, I mean, that's an interesting question to wonder. I'm sure it's actually, they both are just got to be in thousands and thousands. So anyway, once again, we want to thank our good friend Scott Bowden from Kentucky Fried Wrestling, the podcast on the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Scott, we want to thank you so much for joining us, and we appreciate
it. Thank you,
Scott. Thank you. And I love this, too, not only to talk a little wrestling with you guys, but also the fact that this is only going to further confuse the masses. Bowden appearing on Bowdren Show. See, even I can't keep it straight.
All right, buddy. Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So we would like to thank our friend Scott Bowden for joining us here. Always a pleasure to talk a little Mempho wrestling with Scott. He is the Barry Rose of Memphis. Barry is my go-to man for all things Florida wrestling, along with guys like Howard Baum, Pete Lederberg, Greg Good. They are the guys to talk to when you want to talk Florida wrestling. So our last match we're going to talk about today, Barry, we're going to go back into my top 10 at number 4. Now, this is a bit of a controversial choice because when you get into the Flair Steamboat trilogy of 89, you have some people that are fans of the Nashville match. You have some fans that are fans of the New Orleans match. But today, my match that I had number 4, February 20th, 1989 in Chicago, we had Ric Flair versus Ricky Steamboat, their first meeting since Steamboat's return. Barry, tell me what you feel about this match.
So maybe this is the strongest of the three, and I only say that because it was Steamboat's return. You know, it's a 5-star match. If there's such a thing as you want to put a star rating on it, this is really as good as it's going to get. And we're really talking about two of the greatest in-ring performers, not just of that generation, but would really of all time. What really sucks me in on this match is these two guys who, from a cardiovascular standpoint, I feel like Gordon Sully now, from a cardiovascular standpoint, these two guys go full tilt right from the get-go. There's no sitting in a headlock for 5 minutes. There's nothing. This match is quick-paced. The chops that these guys are trading, and Flair selling Steamboat's chops like he's been hit with a baseball bat. And I love the commentator. The commentator is playing up the difference between the hard-working family man Steamboat and the hard-partying Flair. And everything they do in the ring kind of backs up what they're being described as. There's a great spot. It's about 17 or 18 minutes into the match where both men tumble over the top rope outside the ring. And it's really just a thing of beauty to watch this also. And I don't know if you remember this. But the following Saturday, after Steamboat had won the title, do you remember how the show opened up, how TBS opened up on World Championship Wrestling? They did a cold opening, and it's Ricky Steamboat kneeling in the ring. Teddy Long is holding up the championship belt with one hand and the Dragon's other hand in victory. And then Gary Michael Capetta is announcing the results. And I just thought that was so dramatic. And, you know, we'll rag on and we'll shit on WCW NWA for everything that they did wrong. And they really did a lot wrong. But this was done so right. I have a question for you. So Hiro Matsuda, and I believe this was all part of the JTEC Corporation, if I'm correct at this point, but so Hiro Matsuda is outside the ring with Ric Flair at this stage. Hiro Matsuda is legendary, but he didn't need to be outside the ring. Would this have been a better match, and I don't know if that's even the right way to even phrase that, if J.J. Dillon had been outside the ring? Would this have been better? Would it have not? Would JJ, who always got involved as a manager, would that have detracted maybe from the match? Maybe Hiro was better because he really didn't do a whole much? What do you think?
Well, I will say that it could not have been worse with JJ, because Hiro Matsuda, as great as he was in Florida as a wrestler, those matches with like guys like Danny Hodge, Jerry Briscoe, as a manager, he was the proverbial fart in church, completely useless. I hated the JTEX Corporation gimmick. And Hiro was, he was one of those guys that he didn't do anything as a manager other than stand there in a suit and occasionally slap the mat. You know, there are guys that I know that have worked independents in Florida. I'm not going to mention any names, who are also completely useless at ringside. I have a feeling you know who I'm talking about. But,
yes,
you know, he just stood there and did nothing. So how could JJ have been worse? Because JJ on his worst day would have been better than this. And
well,
on his,
so what I'm, what I mean, though, and I want to make sure that I quantify this, was Hiro didn't really do anything in this match. And
no.
Was this match better because this match focused solely on the two guys in the ring? Where JJ, who is, in my opinion, one of the greatest managers of all time, would it maybe have detracted from what the beauty, it's like fucking ballet we're watching in the ring between these two guys. Would it have detracted a little bit? That's kind of what I meant by that.
No, and from that point of view, I understand what you're saying. Yes, maybe it was better that JJ wasn't there, because you could just solely concentrate. You weren't sitting there waiting for the hammer to fall with JJ throwing the shoe into the ring or somehow getting involved, taking the bump, and there being some sort of crazy screw job finish. So from that point of view, and of course there was a reverse screw job finish, but from that point of view, and I understand what you mean now, it was probably better that JJ wasn't there.
Gotcha. Okay. That's what I was asking. Great.
Yeah. So as I watched the match last night, here's a couple things I noted. First of all, you had Jim Ross and Magnum TA on the call. A lot of people have commented that this might've been Jim Ross's greatest call of a match, because he really was calling this like he was calling a boxing match or an MMA fight. Magnum TA, who I never really cared for as an announcer, was actually pretty darn good in this match. I mean, he added some pretty knowledgeable points. He came off like he really knew what he was talking about. They really made a point of throwing out the NWA history in here. There was actually a Frank Gotch and a George Hackenschmidt reference. I was like,
yes.
Good Lord, where did that come from? You know, they were really pushing that we wrestle here in the NWA. And as I was talking to Barry earlier, you know, one of the things we pointed out was how unnecessary it was for you to point out the differences between you and your opposition. Why don't you just let them be what they are? You concentrate on improving yourself rather than pointing out. And that's something I didn't really care when Bill Watts did it in Mid-South. I didn't like it when they were doing it in the NWA and WCW, you know, taking shots at the WWF, because all it did was bring attention to the WWF, and I don't think that was necessary. We had a lot of star power at ringside. You had Kurt Becker from the Chicago Bears and Brad Muster, who happened to be sitting right next to Dave Meltzer at ringside, alongside Steve Dr. Lucha Sims, who was a big darling of the Observer readers page at this point. So Barry pointed out the chops in this match. Good Lord. They're laying them in, and you're just cringing. And as much as I've heard my friend John Hitchcock in a previous episode of this show talk about Wahoo and Johnny Valentine, I can't imagine that Wahoo and Johnny Valentine or Flair and Garvin were laying them in any harder than Steamboat and Flair were that night. They were just really just nailing each other with the chops. I like the thing where they did a close-up on the belt and said, this is the prize they're wrestling for. One of the things that really surprised me, we spoke earlier in this tape about Lawler and Dundee's feud and how Dundee, they pointed out on that broadcast how Dundee still has his fans. Well, in this one, there were fans, obviously, of Flair, as they, even though he was the heel, because there was an audible chant of Steamboat Sucks, which I thought that was pretty funny that they chose to ignore that. We had a Linda Ruffa sighting. Linda Ruffa was the thought of as the hot Japanese photographer. She was the lady that covered the matches for the Japanese magazines back then. I thought it was a little cringeworthy that they referred, Jim Ross referred to Hiro Matsuda at one point as the evil man from the Orient. That was one of these not things that wouldn't fly today. But I like the fact they showed a table full of guys and they said, this is the table for the Illinois State Athletic Commission. Again, really putting this over as an athletic contest. You know, this was something that was, they almost wanted to make you think that this was sort of the equivalent of like a boxing match, which I thought was really interesting. The fact that Steamboat was said to be, you know, he's wrestling tonight for the working class people. You made a brief mention of that, Barry, and, you know, that was kind of. But the finish that they did famously was sort of regarded as a match where they wanted to kind of give the middle finger to Dusty, who is so famous for doing what is known as the Dusty finish, where you had the ref bump. He pins the heel down. Then, of course, the second referee comes in and switches the decision back to the heel. Well, in this one, Teddy Long comes in, counts Flair out. Steamboat wins. Tommy Young has been knocked down. Tommy Young gets back. And it's funny because you can see Flair go over to Tommy Young and sort of hold his hand up over his mouth and say something to Tommy. And then Tommy goes over and lifts Steamboat's hand. Flair begins throwing a bit of a tantrum because he's lost the belt. But it was a real interesting finish to the match because it was done with malice aforethought, I'm sure.
Yeah, but I liked the finish too. It was it was definitely something that I thought worked in the context of it. And we had mentioned Tommy Young in one of our earlier episodes about being the third man in the ring for these matches. And really, Tommy Young has to get kind of like some of the credit with that because you've got arguably, again, the two best in-ring performers of that generation. And Tommy Young really knew how to work with those guys.
Yeah, and, you know, Jim Ross makes a point of saying that the third man in the ring tonight is Tommy Young, the finest official in our sport today. And at that point, there was no question that Tommy Young was the best guy working. An incredible former. So anything more about that? This match definitely holds up as a top 10 match of the decade. Just absolute brilliance in the ring by both guys, both coming off strong. Barry, anything more you want to say?
No, just a heavy recap on this, too, is I would recommend it. You know, all the Flair Steamboat stuff has to be watched. The Henning and Bockwinkel match, through the roof to me. You know, it's just one of those matches you see. I haven't seen it in probably 30 years since it aired. And when I sat down to watch it, I literally was like, I was going to get my wife, who can't stand wrestling, and say, you got to watch this match. It's incredible. Definitely. These two matches you really want to check out for sure.
Yeah, and again, the buildup of the Lawler-Dundee match is so, as good as the match is, the buildup for the match is almost better than the match.
Yeah, exactly. And again, Memphis was so good at building up their matches.
Sure, sure. So now we want to take a different direction. Now it is time for us to talk about the television show Stranger Things. So before we get there, let me explain to you what happened. So As I said, I had a Christmas break, looking to do a little show binging, reached out to some friends, tell me some shows that I can check out on Netflix or that I've missed on the networks, which is probably not a very good chance of that. So I took a look at four shows, and I want to recommend all four shows, but we're going to go a deep dive into Stranger Things. The first one is a show called Ozark with Jason Bateman, which is about a lawyer who works in Chicago, he's a financial advisor, excuse me. And he is laundering money for the Mexican cartel, and he and his family are forced to flee Chicago to the Ozark Mountains in Missouri, and they set up shop there to continue working for the Mexican cartel. I just watched the first episode. Very well done. Very good show. The second show I watched was a show called Peaky Blinders. That is with Cillian Murphy, and it's a show about the mob in London in the late 1910s and into the early 1920s. A really good show. And the third show that I want to mention, I am completely drawing a blank on right now.
You just mentioned Peaking Blinders. Isn't Tom Hardy in that too?
No. If he is, he was not in the first episode. I can tell you that. Maybe he comes along further in the show. But I tell you what, I'll come back and I'll think of what the other show is. Let's talk Stranger Things. I had had some people recommend this show to me, had just kind of let it pass. And I watched the first episode and I reached out to Barry and I said, have you ever watched this show before? It is crazy good. And what it reminded me of, it's got a little bit of E.T., got a little bit of the X-Files, reminding me a lot of a movie that came out that was really underrated that I really liked, a Steven Spielberg movie called Super 8, which came out, within the last 5 or 10 years, that was about young kids in a small town who stumbled upon something they shouldn't have. Let's just put it that way. But very much along those same storylines. Barry, why don't you tell the folks who have never had a chance to see Stranger Things a little bit about what the basic plot revolves around?
Yeah, too. And I would also throw in that it's a little bit like the movie Goonies.
Yes, there is an aspect to that, too.
And even the recent film It, you know, is that, yeah, that there's a lot. So, trying to describe this movie. So there's a group of kids, and one of the kids, they're kind of, I guess they're nerds, they're outcasts, they're really fantastic kids, though, and a young boy named Will disappears. And it really is everybody trying to find him and get him back. You know, his mother's played by Winona Ryder, but, you know, they all band together. It's his mother, it's the police chief, and then he's got this group of friends. And this group of friends, they're like the Goonies, they're like the kids from It, like we just said, and they're trying to get him back, but they've got to confront, you know, all these like terrifying forces and all these kind of like supernatural or unnatural things in order to get him back. And, you know, so much goes on. And I don't know, Jeff, is there an easier way to describe what this is about?
Well, and besides all that, there's also this governmental agency, and that's where the X-Files comes in, that is sort of also involved in the sinister plot. And these kids are running into this kind of secret government laboratory that's just outside their town. They live in a small town in Indiana. And the first thing I want to say about this show is, much like, and I'm glad you mentioned the movie It, much like the movie It, the one that recently came out, the kid actors in this show are so off the chart good and believable. Now, the show is set in like 82, 83, 84, in that general time frame. And I was not, you know, I graduated high school in 79, so I wasn't that far removed from this time period. It really took me back because I knew these kids in my neighborhood. Kids were this age, and they came off playing it very believably, and that's the first thing that stands out. The second thing, and I'm going to let Barry get into this, the music in this show, because in the first episode of this show, there's this kid who's a teenager who sits down with his younger brother, who ends up being the kid that disappears. And he says, there's something I got to play for you. The younger brother's not really into music. He goes, I want you to listen to this, and I want you to sort of like really understand how important this can be in your life. He pops in a cassette, because that's when cassettes were big, and he kicks in The Clash, who've always been one of my favorite bands. And I believe the song they play is Should I Stay or Should I Go? And I sit there and I went, well, now we're good to go. You know, anybody that's pushing The Clash is okay with me. So I always told my my daughter, Kelly, The Clash is, to use the old quote, the only band that effing matters. So they started off playing The Clash. Barry, why don't you take us in a musical journey of some of the other people that are featured in this show?
Yeah, absolutely, too. And you're right about, you know, there was a period there in the 1980s where the only band that really did matter was The Clash. But I was kind of hooked, too. As soon as I heard that and he pops in the cassette and they're blasting it, I'm going, all right, this was kind of made for me right now, too. And they do play another Clash song, too, which is Radio Clash, which I love. A slight hijack here. I watched a movie on cable last week, and it is a movie called London Town. It is based in England. It is about a young boy whose parents are divorced, and the mother, who doesn't live with the young boy, who's 15 or 14, his mother sends him a tape of The Clash, and he had never heard The Clash, and the whole movie is this journey of him basically with The Clash, go see it. I don't know what channel I saw it on cable, but if you like The Clash, you got to see it. But the music in here really, really is what hooked me. Two things. The kids are fantastic, as you pointed out. This is a character-driven show. You love these kids. You want to hang with these kids. You want to go out and have dinner with these kids. They're fantastic. They're so likable. They're the goodness in all the kids that are out there, for the most part, with the exception of one or two of the characters. But from a musical standpoint, I love what people call new wave, which is alternative music. And for me, and I mentioned this in the Breaking Kayfabe group the other day too. But you know, there was a scene, and it was one of the ending scenes of one of the later episodes in season two, and a song by Icicle Works called Whisper to a Scream, also known as Bird's Fly, came on, and I literally popped right off the couch. I was so excited. And then 2 minutes later, I'm on YouTube, and I'm playing it super, super loud. But, you know, there's The Ghost in You by Psychedelic Furs, Girls on Film, Duran Duran, Just Another Day Boy by one of my personal favorites, Oingo Boingo, Talking in Your Sleep by The Romantics. And here's something. So the Duffer Brothers, this doesn't happen by accident. These guys have done their research. They don't look that old. I mean, by watching Beyond Stranger Things, they don't seem like old guys, but they've really done their research music-wise. There's a song called Go by a band called Tones on Tail that, if you weren't around in the 80s, I don't know how they found this, but that's on there, too. I will say, too, I love the theme. The theme, to me, is this John Carpenter kind of synthesizer, almost video game feel to it, kind of creepiness. But then you hear the theme on Beyond Stranger Things, where they put a little beat behind it. Fantastic. And the theme has become so popular that Blink-182 is actually playing it live in concert now. So, you know, to me, and you and I have talked about this a bunch of times, one of the strong points of a Quentin Tarantino film is his real solid use of a soundtrack. He doesn't just put a song in there without any sort of context or meaning. I feel that in Stranger Things, they're doing that also. Every song has a meaning. They played Ghostbusters by Ray Parker Jr., and here the four kids are dressed up as Ghostbusters going to school. So I think the music truly, truly adds to this.
Yeah, and just for the uninitiated who have never seen the program, the Duffer Brothers that Barry referred to are the two brothers that created the show. And there is on YouTube or on Netflix, you can go after you watch the show. Don't ruin it for yourself and watch it before you've seen both seasons. A show called Beyond Stranger Things, where they sit down with the cast and they discuss different episodes and what was going through the actors' minds when they were portraying these particular scenes. And there's a mix of things that happen that are funny, very dramatic things, and then there's things that are, you know, a little bit scary. Because, you know, we were talking about, is this something that you want to watch with your younger kids? And while I don't think there'd be a problem, there are some people that think, you know, maybe for the real younger kids, there's some scenes that get a little bit intense. You know, you were talking about that scene that we've now discussed where the brother is playing the Clash for his younger brother. You know what it reminded me of, Barry, is from the movie Almost Famous, that, good Lord, that movie's been out 15 years ago now, where the older sister gives the albums to her brother and looks at him and says, "Expand your mind." And yes, she's getting ready to leave home. And that's really what this brother did, is he hooked his brother on this different – and that song, Should I Stay or Should I Go, becomes very important for something that happens, I believe, later in – it's season two, because that the memory of him being taught that song by his brother is called back, and yes, it's a very important plot twist. So it's not just randomly thrown in there. So there's a young girl – that is sort of one of the lead actors. Her name is Millie Bobby Brown, and she is all of 13 years old, and probably was 11 or 12 when it was taped. But
was
this
11
girl,
years old when the filming began for this.
You watch this girl, and you're like, you think you're watching a 30-year-old. The girl is so mature, and the stuff that, you know, the emotional range that she shows in you know, scenes where she's crying or when she's horrified or when she's angry. And I'm watching this, I'm going, I can't believe this girl is 12 or 13 years old, you know, at the time. It's just crazy to think that. And among the scenes that I said, you know, that are funny and touching, and there's and this isn't a big spoiler here. I won't sell too much here, but there's at the end of season two, there is the sort of go home, if you will, is a dance. And all I can say is the scenes that involve the kids at the middle school dance, because these kids are all kids that are in middle school, is so sweet. And, you know, not like, you know, Sound of Music, you know, syrup kind of stuff, but just like one of those things where you go, wow, that was really nice. I really like the way that played out and that character development, how it came around. But before they get there, they go through quite a bit, I guess I could say, Barry.
Yeah, they do too. So I am going to encourage you to everybody listening that if you have not seen this and you don't want this to get spoiled for you, because I'm about to rage and do a fucking spoiler on this. So shut it off. You've got 5 seconds, 4, 3, 2, 1. That last episode that you just referenced, one of my favorite movies is The Big Lebowski, and there is a great scene in there where Mr. Lebowski is sitting in his wheelchair in front of the fireplace, and he says, "Strong men also cry. Strong men also cry." I had a fucking tear in my eye at that last episode. When they're at the snowball, and Eleven, who is the character that you referenced, she is such a phenomenal actress. And she doesn't, you know, you pointed out whether she's crying, whether she's angry, she doesn't even say a lot. I think she says something under 50 lines in season one, but her acting with the expressions on her face. So that last scene at Snowball, and I'm getting a little choked up right now because I believe in these characters. This is believable stuff to me. And they're at the Snowball and they're dancing and they finally get their kiss. And I don't know if you caught it, but Eleven has a hair tie in her hair. And that is the same hair tie that Hopper had been wearing around his wrist. Hopper is the police chief whose daughter passed away, and he is quote-unquote kind of adopted Eleven. To see her wearing that hair tie at the dance and dancing with Mike, honestly, was like the Super Bowl for me right at that moment. And I'm even getting choked up now. So powerful, so beautiful. When it was over, I was really upset that there wasn't more. That there weren't more episodes right at that time. At the same time, I walked away and I said, you know, this is what great television, great art is supposed to do to you. You're supposed to be moved by it. And legitimately, I was moved by that final scene at Snowball.
Yeah, let me just say that, you know, one of our go-to reference points on this show and in my life, and I think in Barry's life, is the app that's called IMDb. IMDb is the Internet Movie Database, and it's really so key whenever you want to find a movie, if you want to see what people thought of it, is it a good movie, am I going to waste my time watching this? Now, let me tell you something. They throw out good ratings like people throw around manhole covers. That's a really old reference there. But if you get anything above, like, say, a 7, 7.5, you're entering into good territory. You get above 8, you're entering really good territory. You get above an 8.5 on IMDb, you're talking about elite all-time shows like The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, Deadwood, Game of Thrones. I'm looking right now at IMDb, Stranger Things, the show gets a 9.0. They don't give out that kind of grade to just any show. This is a show that's strongly rated. You're going to see this show win tons and tons of awards during the award season that comes up. I do want to mention a couple people that we forgot. I'm going to get into the character of Dustin is played by a young kid named Gaten. How do you pronounce his last name, Barry?
Gaten Matarazzo.
Okay, we're going to discuss him in just a second. But for those of you, again, that haven't seen it, we have people like Winona Ryder, who, let me tell you something. When you see Winona Ryder playing the kid or the mother of like a teenage boy and another boy, you sit there and you go, holy crap, do I feel old seeing that. In season two, we have Sean Astin. And we have in season one, we have Matthew Modine. Paul Reiser comes into season two. Let me talk about Matthew Modine in season one. Matthew Modine plays a character that works this lab outside of town. So he's got gray hair. His hair looks like Ted Danson when Ted Danson was on Cheers. But Barry before in previous episodes has talked about his brushes with celebrity. Okay. They usually start off with, I used to work at this restaurant in New York. Mine does not start off that way. My wife and I took our kids up to Chicago a few years back, and we were going to a Notre Dame game. So it was like fall, something like that. So we spent a couple days before that in Chicago. So we're walking down on Michigan Avenue, and on Michigan Avenue, there is, I believe it's the WGN radio station is right along Michigan Avenue. There's a big window where you can watch the DJ, you know, doing the show. And so we were just standing there for about 30 seconds watching the DJ working his magic there on WGN. And as we're standing there, there's a guy standing just to the left of us, you know, by himself. And he's kind of waving to the DJ. I don't know. I guess he knew him. And so, you know, we finished. We're walking around the corner. And all of a sudden I stop and I turn back and I look. And I looked at my wife and I go, holy shit, that's Matthew Modine. That's Pat, that's Private Joker from Full Metal Jacket. And apparently he did know the DJ because right then he walked in. That was my opportunity to talk with Private Joker. I completely blew it, but he was standing by God next to me outside the studios of WGN. That's my brush with greatness. Now I finally got one. I got one on the board on you, Rose.
I love it too, and so, I love it. So is it, I don't know if it's Modine or Modine, but he, the first time I ever saw him was in a movie, and I'm only bringing this up because I can reference Phoebe Cates, a movie called Private School from 1983, and it was on cable the other night, and I watched it. And it's not a great movie, and he's in it, but Phoebe Cates is in the movie, so definitely has to be seen. He's also in two other movies that I like a lot. One is Vision Quest, 1985, where he plays a high school wrestler who also has an affair or wants to have an affair with the very smoking Linda Fiorentino. And then he did a movie called Birdie, which came out in the late 80s, which it would take me an hour to try to describe what that was about. And was based off of a Broadway play, but he's a really solid actor, and I hadn't seen a lot that he had done. So the fact that he's in this show and he really plays a great character, and I'm really glad that you brought him up. Did you get a photo with him? Or
I did not. I'm a complete idiot, as I mentioned to our producer, the great Brian Last, for I am Costanza, the Lord of the Idiots. So I will tell you, Vision Quest, in my estimation,
sure,
possibly the greatest wrestling movie of all time. It's a movie about a kid who's a high school wrestler, and it's just a great, great story. I'm even not offended by Madonna being part of the soundtrack.
She was very good. I thought that she did. I like the song. It's Crazy for You, if I'm correct. And they play it every 10 minutes. Because they whenever there's a lull, they just start to play the song. Vision Quest, and again, Captain Hijack. Vision Quest is such a good movie, but have you watched it recently? There's something in there that's very odd.
Is it him going through her dirty clothes? That was the scene I was thinking of right now.
That's a little odd. He essentially, there's a scene in there where he believes that she's sleeping with the African-American teacher, and he gets really jealous. I just watched this a month ago, and he borderline sexually, I don't know if it's even borderline, he sexually assaults her, and then she, I guess, slaps him or pushes him away, and then he comes to grips with what he did, and they reconcile and just move on from it. And it was 1985, so I guess the mindset in 85 was, he's mad, he's a kid, he's blowing off steam. Certainly in today's political climate, you know, you could never do that. So it was just odd to see it. But I will say, as a wrestling movie, it's fantastic. And I love the first half of the movie. Do you remember his teammate, the kid with the mohawk?
His teammate was the kid that played Jake in 16 Candles. I don't know what the actor's name is.
Yeah, you know, so you just fucking won the lottery right there. That is exactly who it is. That's Jake from 16 Candles with the mohawk right there. Yeah,
yes, absolutely. Anyway, we got sidetracked there on the Vision Quest. Getting back to Stranger Things, Gaten Matarazzo plays Dustin. And he has got a really interesting background. This kid apparently was born with some rare genetic, I don't want to say defect, but he was essentially born without a collarbone. I've never heard this. And
cleidocranial dysplasia.
Yeah. And so there is a point in season one, like one of the first episode or two, where a bully comes up and says, do the thing with your shoulders. And he's able to kind of like flex where his shoulders come together in front because he doesn't have a collarbone, and it kind of freaks everybody out. And that's a shoot. They did that because he had that condition. He's missing his front teeth, which is also a part of that condition, is you have a problem with your teeth. And but All that being said, this kid is such a likable kid. And if you watch the Beyond Stranger Things afterwards, the actor, it's a shoot. He's the same kid. He's so stinking likable. And probably of the whole cast, he's the most likable kid in the whole cast.
I would fully agree with that, too. This kid is, he is a human walking teddy bear. You literally want to go up and you want to give him the biggest hug. Of everyone on that show, my 13-year-old daughter has developed an enormous crush on Gaten Matarazzo. So much, in fact, that we are buying tickets on January the 11th to go see him in concert. He's playing at the Starlin Ballroom in Sayreville, New Jersey with his band. And it's on February the 3rd. My daughter found out. She had tears in her eyes. Will you please take me? Of course. And five of my friends? I don't know about that. But, exactly. But we are getting tickets to go see Gaten and his band, which I'm assuming will be probably, you know, about – it's actually a 2,500-seat arena. In Green Day just played there recently. But Gaten played – 2 weeks ago, the Stone Pony in New Jersey, the world famous Stone Pony, wow. Bruce Springsteen and all sure. that. Right, exactly. And sold it out. So he's got a following. And I don't know if it's the music. This is the most likable human being that may have ever walked the face of the earth.
Well, and, you know, they have been on I know they were on James Corden's show doing a music. The four lead kids have got some sort of sidekick going where they're like almost like the Backstreet Boys. They go on there. They went on Jimmy Fallon, and I think they did a musical number there. And they're actually not half bad. They do like a Motown section.
Yeah, exactly. I'm kind of looking forward to it, man.
Yeah. So, but I can't even begin to tell you people how much I can recommend this show. Wow. And as Barry said, the worst part about watching and binge watching both seasons and going through the Beyond Stranger Things is a realization that you're probably gonna have to wait till summer to get more episodes because, wow, this is just extremely, extremely good stuff. I would like to mention that the one show that I forgot in the beginning was a show called Godless starring Jeff Daniels. That also looks to be a really entertaining show. And if you want to check that out, any show that starts off, a Western that starts off where there's been a mass murder, yeah, you know you're going in the right direction there for a program. So anyway, anything further, Barry, or would you begin to wrap this up?
This is probably going to be like a six-hour show, but I just wanted to point out a couple of things. I don't think I can walk away from Stranger Things if I don't point out two or three more things. One is the character 11. My God, she is my favorite character. She is a tremendous actress, but I heard this story, and it was, I found this on YouTube. So the Duffer Brothers were on NPR, and this is probably, you know, 6 or 7 months ago, and they were talking about Millie Bobby Brown, who plays 11, about how they said that she is an actress beyond her years, that, you know, she was 11 when this show started, that she knows how to position herself as far as the lens or camera positions more than adult actors even know how to do it. And they said that she's so endearing, that she's such a professional that you forget that she's a kid. And one day she shows up on set covered head to toe in glitter. And they said, "Millie, what's going on?" And they said, "Oh, I don't know where the glitter came from." And they had to take 45 minutes to get the glitter off of her. And one of the Duffer Brothers went up and said, "You know, we've never had this problem with any of our adult actors. You know, David Harbour, who plays, you know, the sheriff, he's not coming in covered in glitter." I just thought that was so endearing because these kids are so good. You forget they're kids sometimes, you know. Yeah. They're just so good.
And, you know, besides the main four kids, there's also a group of actors that are like the older brothers and they're teenagers, like, you know, junior, senior in high school. And those kids are great too. And you watch those kids and you're like, man, I totally remember one of those kids being in my class. You know, you got the jock athlete that's played by, his name is Joe Keeley, I believe, who's probably got the best hair going out there. I mean, this kid's hair is just epic. And the older sister, very believable. There's, you know, in season two, you get another character introduced to the high school who's very just a real asshole. And you watch that guy and you go, "Oh, I totally remember that guy from high school too." So it's not just the younger middle school kids. There's a group of high school kids that are also extremely believable, and the actors do a really good job.
Everybody does too. So,
yeah.
And you just mentioned the character Billy too. Now, did you know? And there's probably 50 Stephen King references or some sort of nod to Stephen King in the show. And I know how much you love Stephen King. Did you know that the Billy character is an homage to Randall Flagg, who is one of the main villains in Stephen King literature?
Okay, yeah, yeah, and the lead character in The Stand.
Exactly, long hair, denim from head to toe, the earring. If you ever, if you've ever seen him, they're almost identical too. But yeah, so one more thing I wanted to point out too: the kid who plays Will, who is Noah Schnapp. So in the beginning episodes, and he wasn't in a lot of season one. It was really more towards the end, and then in season two. The acting that this kid is doing, especially when, you know, his body's going through all the things that his body is going through because of the upside down, his acting for a kid who, again, you know, 12, maybe 13 years old, this is off the charts, just absolutely off the charts. A couple other things I wanted to point out, and I'm going to point out 40 more things until Brian says, that's it, you guys are done. The font in Christine and Cujo, which is Stephen King, is almost identical. It's another Stephen King reference. Is almost identical to the Stranger Things font. And then, do you remember the scene where the state trooper is guarding the morgue and he's reading a book? He's reading Cujo.
Yeah, lots of shout outs to Stephen King. The one last person I do want to mention on this show, because we've mentioned Stephen King, we brought up Stephen King's movie It. The lead kid, I guess I could say, is a kid named Mike, is played by Finn Wolfhard, I believe is his name.
Greatest porn name ever.
Yeah, Finn, right?
Wolfhard.
Exactly. He was one of the kids in the movie It, and he plays Mike, who's sort of the lead in all this. And he is another kid that is so believable. And the relationship that he has with Eleven is spot on for kids of that age, and you know, the angst that they go through, really well done. And when you watch beyond Stranger Things, you really get a feel for the personality of these kids and an appreciation of the great work they do. Strongest recommendation by the good folks here at Breaking Kayfabe with Baudrin and Barry. So now, that being said, before we get to great Brian Last on top of us here complaining about going long again, I would just like to mention that you can follow me on Twitter at Baudrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is available. My book is still available with my good friend Scott Teal over there at Crowbar Press. Come on, people. I got a wedding. My daughter's getting married in October. Let's buy up some copies of that book. Thank you again, Travis Heckle, for the outstanding artwork, not just on my podcast, but on the Kentucky Fried Wrestling podcast that our friend Scott Bowden does. Special thanks to Brian Last and the Arcadian Podcast Network, Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Excuse me, Brian. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And until next time, go watch Stranger Things.